We gotta go! We gotta get out of here! We gotta go right now!
Listen to me, Steve.
No, you don't understand! We've gotta go!
Go where?
No, we gotta go! What the hell are you talking about?
Steve, this is important. Go where? That's right. Go where? What happened in your room? Are you listening? What happened in your room is not an isolated incident. It is something that is happening everywhere to everyone. So, where are you gonna go? Where are you gonna run? Where are you gonna hide? Nowhere. Because there's no one like you left.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I am your host, Jason Bishop. I'm your very tired host because I've been staying awake. When you sleep, that's when they get you. I'm a little worried today, but we'll find out. You can help me discern whether our co-hosts today are pod people, aren't we all, or regular people. Joining us today is Sam Stepanenko.
Am I a pod person or am I a pod person?
Who would ever be able to tell with you?
That was mean.
It's Sam.
But accurate.
It's Sam. He's good. And Trish Coughlin.
Welcome to the pod.
You're
pod
on.
Pod gardening is very wonderful.
You're on the list. And Jeff Omega.
Hello, everybody. It is a pleasure to be on the podcast, as always. I have many fond memories of being on this show with all of you.
Yeah, your absence is now being explained from last week. All right.
Was he patient zero?
It's very possible. And I don't know. You know, Trish was talking about being happy and talking about puppies before the show, and that's pretty unlike her, too. So, okay, we'll try to get through it. Thank God we're doing this remotely, Sam. So don't disclose your location.
Unfortunately, they both know my location.
Mm-hmm.
That's problematic.
You're feeling sleepy, Sam.
I'm always sleepy. You can't. No, I'm always sleepy.
Take some hits of caffeine and let's get on with the show. We're going to be talking about Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1956, Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1978, Body Snatchers from 1993, and The Invasion from 2007, and possibly a few other things. It's a lot of invading things, and this will be the final week of Alien Invasion April with a very different kind of invasion. One we're quite fond of, because it's almost our namesake. It's the one that everybody asks, are you named after Invasion of the Body Snatchers? And the answer is always, no, other things invade. It is the number two thing when you search Invasion of the Remake that you will find on Google. It'll be Invasion of the Remake, and Body Snatchers will come up next. So we figured we'd just get out of the way, so when you search either, both of us will come up.
Yes.
It'll always be right.
It'll always be right now. So we're condensing four movies into this. We're going to try this again. It's been a long, long time since we've attempted four movies in an episode. And we're going to be a little more loosey-goosey with this, throwing the regular format out the window. And we'll try to hit these each at a time. But at the same time, it's going to be structured a little more like our Werewolf special or 31 Days of Horror, that sort of thing.
Because there's a lot.
There's a lot.
But is there really? When you really think about it?
Well, I mean, there's four movies, but I'd say there's a lot more that are either direct ripoffs or certainly inspired by, which makes it the birth of a rather large subgenre of science fiction and horror. Yes.
But yeah, in terms of these four movies, I mean, there's not a lot different between all three of them or all four of them.
No.
Yeah.
I was surprised at how true to that sort of first movie all the subsequent movies really were. I mean, there's changes, obviously, but the core concepts were the same.
The third one took me pleasantly by surprise the first time I saw it, just because I think that one is the most different out of all of them. It tries to do the same world, but in a slightly different context.
And see, well,
Body Snatchers?
Yeah, and I might disagree there. Like, I actually think that is a rather underrated movie myself, but I actually think the last one did the most to change things, maybe not successfully, but it did try, and maybe by doing so straight away from the core concept. But it did get me thinking about how science fiction, a lot of the times, is intentionally meant to be an allegory of the times, and sometimes it is in hindsight. Now, in 1956, they intended, for the most part, just to make a science fiction movie based on the Jack Finney novel, and they just wanted to make fun kind of action horror thriller for the 50s audience, and it wasn't something out of the realm. There was a lot of that happening. Now, the director, Don Siegel, may have seen it as a commentary on McCarthyism and mindless conformity and even communism in the Red Scare. But it certainly wasn't scripted that way with intent. And when you jump into the 2007, now with 2021 eyes, that movie has a lot more relevance. Like, I saw that movie in 2007 and I'm like, eh, that's not so great. And it strays away from the concept, and the fact that there were no pods really irritated me. But from 2021 eyes, with the pandemic,
viral aspect of it.
The viral aspect of it and the current pandemic we're all living through, isolation and paranoia, and that whole fear of each other already that we live with for the last year or so, that movie has a lot more relevance than it did then and might actually be perceived as a much better movie now because of something we can relate to it.
Well, I think when The Invasion originally came out, that was around the same time as the Ebola crisis was happening, was it not?
One of, possibly.
Yeah.
But yeah, it doesn't have the same resonance because it didn't affect as globally as our current COVID thing is happening, right? I mean, Ebola is scary, but really, in terms of scale, it's much, much smaller.
And there was also, I think, H1N1 around the same time. There was a bunch of other smaller scale viruses that people were getting freaked out.
Yeah, there was
about
the original corona scares, and I mean, we have them all the time. I mean, that's not something that's changed. It's just the absolute scale of what we're going through right now is what makes this so relevant now, is what Jay was saying, is because we all experience it. We're all in lockdown. We're all experiencing that isolation, like he said, and that paranoia. Like, you don't want anybody coming too close to you because you don't know. You generally don't know if they're going to be the one who transmits this potentially fatal disease to you.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's where Jay was going with that.
Oh, no, totally. I think accidentally, there is a lot of stuff in the public consciousness in the 2000s about like virus movies and infection, and like zombie movies had a revival, and like viruses were kind of one of the go-to tropes that horror movies are starting to use a lot, just because we were having a bunch of small outbreaks that were relatively controllable, but they still freaked people out. But yeah, now with COVID, I think that there's an entire period of movies that were kind of overlooked when they came out that are resonating with people much harder now, just because, I mean, we're living in one of those movies.
Mm-hmm. To an extent, yeah.
So I was mentioning right before the recording started with The Invasion on the YouTube comments, because you can watch it for free on YouTube. There's a lot of people commenting stuff about how the movie is like an example of what's going on right now. And they're like, see, we're right. You don't need to take the vaccine, because the vaccine is going to control people, just like in this movie. And all, you know, that whole rabbit hole. So maybe it's not resonating in a good way with some people right now.
Well, and that's ironic, because the whole point of at the end of that movie is they isolate it and they actually find a vaccine that defeats it.
Yeah.
So they've missed the fucking point if they're saying that you don't have to take the vaccine, because this is actually a great allegory for how vaccines actually are beneficial.
Yeah. And what's funny is I'm pretty sure they're seeing the illusion of being possibly empathetic or understanding with people as being like a pod person, which is fucking stupid and ridiculous.
I do like the pod person concept.
Yeah, well, that was more QAnon sense from commenters out there, but hopefully people get the point of that movie. Now, like, Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1956, classic movie. I don't know if you guys had seen any of these before. The only one that wasn't familiar to me was the 1993. I don't think I'd ever seen that one before, but I had seen the rest before, and I was really looking forward to doing these. And even though the later ones aren't quite as good, it's amazing when you watch the 1956 and then you see the 78, and it's just as good in a kind of a different way. You've moved from the small town into the big city, San Francisco, and its bohemian society. It is a little hippie when you watch it with the mud baths and stuff. But and Leonard Nimoy's half glove.
I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah. Yes, please.
That's his masturbation hand. No, he deliberately wore that so it'd make his character look more distinctive and stand out. Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I noticed it right away too. I'm like, is that your wanking hand? But apparently he knew somebody who wore a glove like that to cover up burns and stuff. And he thought that might add to his character. So
yeah, not without explanation.
Not without explanation. It just looks fucking weird. Yeah. That movie really stands up. When we look at our entire library of covering remakes and stuff, I would call that one of the best I've ever seen.
Oh, I totally agree. It was my favorite of all the ones I watched.
Yeah.
I think part of it was the music. I mean, the music just, and I don't usually talk about music because it's not sort of in my milieu, but the music, I just found it really affecting all the way through the movie. And the ending was what I wanted from all of these movies.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I really like the fact that there was that ambiguity at the ending. Is there recovery from this invasion?
Yeah, that was something that Philip Kaufman wanted to kind of reinstate from the original, because Don Siegel originally wanted to have a more dour ending rather than have that upbeat ending that, okay, maybe we society finds out and defeats it. Now, the original novel actually has a more upbeat ending too, as the aliens give up. Like, there's too much resistance from humanity for conformity, so they leave in the novel. But it's a little, definitely a little different in every iteration, but I certainly appreciated that it didn't feel like there was any end in sight. It was already too late in the 78, and that was pretty cool. I want to go back to Sam's comment about the music, though, and even the soundscape. It is really an interesting movie to watch in a lot of ways. I mean, it's very 70s in its approach because it feels like you're walking in on these people's lives in progress, so it feels very real in that regard. But there's a lot in this happening in the soundscape. So as you're listening, if you're listening really closely, it's a very lively world. And then as the sound design moves later into the film, the nature sounds like birds and animals and stuff fade out. And it's just the city sounds. It gets quieter and quieter. And so does the soundtrack. By the end, there's no music at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it just completely intensifies your sense of discomfort through the whole movie. I found it incredibly affecting. And the thing I really enjoyed is if you happen to be looking away, like you were looking to sort of look at a cast member or something like that, because I do that sometimes while we're watching, the change in music made me look up, okay, what am I missing? Right? Like it really brings you into the story and sort of grabs your attention. And I just found that really, and that's why I saved it for last, because I knew it was like sort of the epitome of a remake of a classic on top of it all. It's really iconic. So I wanted to wait and see that one last. And I did, and enjoyed it thoroughly.
And speaking of like not just the sound design, that sound that the pod people make when they find like an intruder, that's so iconic. Everybody knows that one. It's like, even if you've never seen it, it's like, just that screaming.
And that final shot too of Donald Sutherland with pointing and screaming is, even if you've never seen the movie, you know that shot.
You know, it's what's really funny actually is, so when me and my wife got married a bunch of years ago, we did a bunch of wedding photos after the wedding, as you normally do. But me and my best man, Alex, we were really, really big fans of the 70s Invasion of the Body Snatchers. and he had Donald Sutherland hair at that time from that movie. So in one of the photos, unbeknownst to the photographer, there's like this nice shot of both of us, and then he's like way in the background, out of focus, doing the Donald Sutherland like pointing and screaming face, and because he has the same hair, it is absolutely hilarious.
That's awesome.
That's wonderful. That's so amazing.
I don't know if you guys felt the same way about the 93. I felt like it was almost a sequel to the 78 because it uses a lot of the same rules that the 78 establishes, and including the scream and the pointing. So for me, in my mind anyway, it was almost set in the same world, and just because it's also different characters. It's the only one that departs from the character names that we would see in all the other versions of the Driscolls and Kaufman and the Belichicks.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like it almost happened in the same world. It does make it sound like the invasion happened really slowly when they're 20 years apart, but
yeah,
that would be my main, because when I first watched it, I kind of thought the same thing, but because it takes place 20 years later, in my mind, I was like, I don't think it would take that long for it to happen, for it to be something that people don't know what's going on, because you'd think it would be something that they would hear about. But I could see it being kind of one of those things where maybe the filmmakers are like, we've done the original movie twice already, so let's just assume that that same story happened in the 90s, and then we'll follow up that. It's kind of what it felt
like. It is a complete movie. It certainly doesn't rely on any previous narrative. It's complete, and it still pulls from things from the other two versions. I mean, it pulls a lot from the 70s, but it's still, there's things that pop in from both the 56 and the 78. So it's heavily informed by both, but at the same time, it might have some of the scariest moments. I think as a whole, it's a weaker script, but it does have some pretty scary moments in it with, especially when they drop the kid out of the helicopter near the end.
Yes.
Man, there's not a lot of hope at the end of that one either.
No.
I think that the third one, it's so underrated. And what blew me away about it the most was, even though the 70s one does have some legitimately really cool special effects, the third one just goes to this whole body horror scale level with the pod people and how they take over the bodies. And I think that that was one of the intentions making the movie, is we never really saw full scale transformation happen from beginning to end. And that was one of the things they wanted to do with the third one. But man, they really nailed those special effects, and like the scene with the bathtub and everything. Yeah, it was freaky. It was creepy. It got under my skin a little bit. Yeah.
And I kind of like the idea that where they changed just like sort of the setting, where it was like kind of a military base. Because when you think about it, it kind of works really well, because like they have all the logistics in place to move things from A to B to C to D. So if you were to invade, that could be your first stop, because also, are you not preventing them from stopping you, you're also using all those resources, which I really kind of liked as a concept.
Yeah. Well, you're also dismantling your biggest defense against it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do think that Jay is right. The script is a bit weaker, and probably part of that is there was a lot of hands that touched the script at various stages to get it to the point that it was. But even though I really like the subtlety of how they introduce the invasions in the other movies, I do also like the way that they introduce it in the third one, where she sees the guy who's freaking out, and she doesn't have context for why he's freaking out. And then she sees him later, and he's like completely normal. And that approach to it, I don't know if it's necessarily better, but for a sequel, not treading the same ground, I liked that approach a lot.
Oh, and the other part where the kid goes to like the daycare, and all the children make the same photo. That is creepy as hell. And that really scared me. It was a really good moment.
It was a really good sort of clue as to what was going on. And the fact that they'd already gotten the children, and it's like, ooh, yeah, that is really creepy, right? And yeah, I missed out on the early part of the conversation there a little bit, but the Jay's sort of suggestion as a sequel, I almost feel like they kind of ignored the time difference and just sort of said, this is happening in the same world at the same time, almost is what it felt like in retrospect, because it is the first one I watched, because I was saving the original and the classic 70s one for last. But
it was my first one too.
Yeah, but when you look at them sort of in context, I think that Jay's kind of hit something on the head. It is definitely the same universe, and they've kind of just disregarded that difference in time.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt about that one too. Now we're gonna take a quick break here because we got four trailers to run for you today. That's kind of awesome. So I'm going to run the trailer for the 1956 and we'll be right back with a lot more Body Snatchers.
Stop! Will you tell these fools I'm not crazy? Make them listen to me before it's too late!
Listen to me. Please listen. If you don't, if you won't, if you fail to understand, then the same incredible terror that's menacing me will strike at you!
They come from another world, spawned in the light years of space, unleashed to take over the bodies and souls of the people of our planet, bringing a new dimension in terror to the giant super scope screen.
Whatever intelligence or instinct it is that can govern the forming of human flesh and blood out of thin air is fantastically powerful, beyond any comprehension.
A cursed, dreadful, malevolent thing was happening to those he loved.
This isn't just an ordinary body, is it?
I never saw one like it. It looks unused.
The sensational star discovery of The View from Pompey's Head. And now an undreamed of horror makes her life and love a vortex of fear.
Jack!
Miles, where do they come from?
I don't know.
Suddenly, while you're asleep, they'll absorb your minds, your memories.
I don't want any part of it.
You're forgetting something, Miles.
What's that?
You have no choice.
From city to city, an incredible hysterical panic spreads. As the unimaginable becomes real, the impossible becomes true.
Stop and listen! Stop and listen to me! Listen! Listen! Listen to me!
That was the trailer for the 1956 Invasion of the Body Snatchers, directed by Don Siegel, based on the serial novel by Jack Finney, with the screenplay by Daniel Mewaring, and an uncredited assist by Richard Collins, starring Kevin McCarthy as Dr. Miles J. Barnell, who also makes a cameo in the 78, Dana Winter as Becky Driscoll, Larry Gates as Dr. Dan Kaufman, King Donovan as Jack Belichick, Caroline Jones as Teddy Belichick, and most famous for being Morticia Adams in The Addams Family. Gene Willis was Nurse Withers, and Ralph Dumke was the police chief, Nick Gruitt. This movie was only shot in like 19 days, and it was 3 days over schedule.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, For the longest time, I didn't realize that this was a Don Siegel movie, and I don't think we've covered any movies that he's directed before, but what a director, also having directed Dirty Harry and a really amazing movie called Charlie Varick, and like he's one of the greats, I think, in my books, and I'm really glad we finally got to talk about one of his movies.
Yeah, no, this is great, and to see how his career would evolve into the 70s as well. He had a lot of the big ones in the 70s, and I would imagine he probably got consulted when the 70s was actually shot.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
Now, another 70s mainstay director was also kind of involved in this, or at least he claims to be. We'll never know for sure. Sam Peckinpah claims to have reworked some of the script, and depending on the day he was telling the story, it was either he did some minor script suggestions to rewrote the whole damn thing. Now, some lawsuits later by the actual screenwriter made Peckinpah kind of back down a little bit, but it's interesting to see that connection to this movie. And as somebody who would just be assisting on set and become later become one of the greatest directors of his era as well.
Yeah.
Because I think Absolutely. He was in it as basically an extra. So he was
yeah,
sure on
he's
set.
In the cast listing.
He's an extra and also crew.
Man. Yeah, we'll never know.
No. Kevin McCarthy, when I was watching this is my first watch for the original. And yeah, Kevin McCarthy, I don't know what it is about him as an actor, but I really enjoy him. I sort of mostly attribute him to Twilight Zone, the movie, because he was in that one section where the kid could do anything. But he was really great in this. You could get that sense of just like paranoia and just trying to make people listen. It was really good.
Yeah, there's this energy about him that works really well in this role. And I was kind of expecting him sort of go into sort of that slightly mad thing that he did later in his career. Mm-hmm. And you could just sort of see it simmering underneath near the end. And I really enjoyed that because you could see that energy without him going sort of that over the top that he did, but as I said, later in his career where he kind of goes a little bit crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, in the 78, he shows up again and is like, oh yeah, no, this character's just kept living.
Yeah.
And this stuff was happening.
That's kind of the fun thing about the 78 when he's running down the traffic, just like he is at the end of the 56 and hits the main character's cars and basically saying the same lines from the original film. And I'm like, man, he's been running for 20 years. He must be exhausted.
Yeah. 22 years to get hit by a car. He's real good at running through traffic.
So that's not the version that I watched, but the original intended version of the 50s movie was supposed to basically end with him running down the streets as everyone was driving towards the pod people and have a much more dour ending. And I was reading that when the 70s movie came out, they re-released the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers in theaters with the original ending without the framing sequence. I haven't found out a lot about that, but it seems that it's not super uncommon for both versions to be the one that people know, especially people checking it out before the remake came out. And yeah, I do think that, especially with the ending of the 70s one, that was also a tribute to kind of the intended ending that Don Siegel wanted for the 50s one. But I think that would have been a strong ending. He's just trying to warn people and they're just driving towards their doom.
Do you think perhaps that the dour ending they originally had planned, they decided not to because it just seemed like the communists would win?
Maybe. I think that
might be part of it, yeah. Because, I mean, like Jay suggested, that they did sort of want to hint at the whole Cold War and stuff. And sort of that sort of subtext of the whole film as an allegory. So it's possible that they wanted to, because especially in the 50s, Americans couldn't lose.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's kind of a bigger part of it is just in movies of that time, it's pretty uncommon to have a story in which the main characters, who are supposed to be defending like the country as a whole, lose and everything goes to hell. I think that probably in the 70s, when a lot of the narrative started to turn, like after the Vietnam War and stuff, that really changed the narrative in movies. But I think that, you know, post-World War II, pre-Korean War, Vietnam, it was very uncommon to have, not happy endings or uplifting endings, especially big budget movies, because it was even the blockbusters weren't really a thing at the time. I would say that Invasion of the Body Snatchers was kind of a blockbuster. It had a big cast, big budget.
Yeah, there were always kind of big names attached to any one of these versions, for sure.
I was actually looking up earlier, just out of curiosity, to see the other types of movies that came out around these movies. And Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the original one, didn't really have that much competition in the vast surrounding months that it came out. So I could see how it really would have made an impact. But the 70s one, a couple weeks before the 70s one came out, Superman came out. And then a week after it came out, George Romero's underrated Martin came out, which probably would have had a similar audience. But Martin, you know, that flew under the radar, probably because people were still seeing Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But Superman was a huge movie, probably one of the biggest movies of 78. So I'm surprised that Invasion of the Body Snatchers didn't get more overshadowed. But I mean, it is an incredible movie. So I'm also not surprised that it got recognition.
Yeah. The 93 had some stiff competition when it opened. It, and unfortunately, didn't get a big wide opening because of the competition. It would open up against Hellraiser 3, Candyman, Dr. Giggles, and Dracula. A lot of horror happening at that time. And I mean, yeah. Bram Stoker's Dracula, everybody was going to see that one. So that one's the most disastrous box office out of the four.
And it's really too bad, because I think that a lot of people for some reason seem to lump in that Invasion of the Body Snatchers with the medieval horrors that came out around a similar time, which aren't very good. Because they came out the same year. I think there was one in 93 and one in 94, or one in 94 and one in 95. But I'd say that if you're listening at home and you haven't watched Body Snatchers, The Invasion Continues, I think you can find it on DVD relatively inexpensively. And it's really worth seeking out to watch. They had a really good people working on it. Good score. It was overall pretty good. I think if you like the 70s one and the 50s one, you'd probably like the 90s one at the very least.
Well, if you like 90s films in general, because the first thing I noticed like 10 minutes in, I'm like, I almost texted Jay. I'm like, oh, this is so 90s.
Yeah.
It is very, very much a 90s film. Thoroughly enjoyable. I mean, it's definitely sort of epitomizes some of the flaws of 90s filmmaking, but in a good way, oddly enough, because 90s filmmaking, they kind of dumbed everything down a little bit. It was more about the spectacle and less about the story in a lot of cases, not always, but in a lot of cases. And that's how this felt. They've dumbed the story down just a little bit to give you more visuals, a little more action, the really superhero character with our military sergeant, the helicopter pilot. It had all of sort of those key 90s elements in it, but it worked really well for this particular film for me.
Yeah, and it's also a bit of a time capsule with the teenager fashion that they have, with like the leather jackets, and they're all listening to 90s metal.
Now, back to the 56 here. Sam, you and I last week, we actually mentioned the Bronson Cave during Robot Monsters. It's here again.
Yes, we did.
It is. Near the end of this movie, the cave that they're hiding in. And there's something of note in that scene as well, as McCarthy and Winter are running for their lives out of town. A lot of running. And she falls asleep in the cave for the briefest of moments. So it's breaking its own rules because she wakes up and she's now potted and has been changed. Whereas we've seen, like, you need to have a pod nearby. And then the body has to grow. That takes time. It doesn't happen. So the movie breaks its own rules in progress. I liked how light those pods actually looked, too. They're all paper mache. I'm like, guys, can you fake that there's some weight? There's supposed to be a body in those things.
Oh,
they were so light.
I liked the gooiness of the pods when they pop open and the goo oozes out. That really delighted me. I thought that was so fun. I love that aspect of it. Just like, boop.
Yeah. I was actually pretty happy with the effects, even in the 56. For their fairly low budget, I mean, they're not going to toss a ton of money at a sci-fi movie. Those were always the B movies, right? But yeah, I always thought it was pretty cool the way it looked. And I thought they did, when they find their first body and it's not fully formed, I'm like, you can kind of recognize it, even though it's not fully formed yet. Considering they had to do full body casts to do that, nude body casts no less, they had to hide all that too. That became an issue with sensors and stuff.
Yeah.
But all those bubbles would hide all the naughty bits anyway. But I thought that looked pretty good. Now, would you dump one of them on a pool table? Probably not.
Not if you want to use that pool table again. I mean, sure, there might be an invasion, but are you going to ruin a very expensive pool table? No.
Right. Yeah. You might want to play a game before the apocalypse ends.
Right. You're hunkering down in your home because there's a big infection outside. You need that pool table.
Yeah. Damn, I'm going to have to rebuild this thing again.
Right.
Stupid alien bodies.
And yeah, that just speaks to some of the 50s kind of silly tropes in there. They did try to actually add a little more humor to that 56. Unfortunately, the producers didn't understand when audiences would laugh and then later, act frightened that's okay. You can actually have humor in a movie. They could not separate that in their brains. Like, no, they can't be laughing and then screaming. They're laughing at a horror movie. Can't have that. So they cut out literally all the humor out of this movie.
No. And it's sad that, that some people just don't understand the release of tension can create more tension.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And we've seen it work so well in so many films. I mean, horror comedy is now a genre because it works so well.
Well, it's the two edges of the sword. Like with humor, you can't constantly keep throwing stuff at people because they'll just get exhausted. You can't do that. It just doesn't, it doesn't work as well, because eventually the laughs just peter out. People lose energy. Same with fear. You can't keep them ratcheted up for the whole time. It just loses steam at some point. So you do have to have it have like peaks and valleys throughout the entire film. Otherwise, it really doesn't work.
Yeah, and you do have those comedic breaks in the 78, because that was essentially what Jeff Goldblum and Veronica Cartwright were for, mm-hmm. primarily. They were there to kind of, before you know, things turn on them, but for the most part, they're there to kind of lighten up the scenes.
Yep,
and they do it very well. Jeff Goldblum's always a joy to see on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Always.
Although, if he kept talking at me while I'm on the phone, I probably would have smacked him and said, go away.
Yeah, I'm surprised that Donald Sutherland didn't do that, actually. I'm like, if you're going for realism, I think I would have just pushed his face away.
Right? I am on the phone.
Especially with Sutherland's reputation at the time, because he was apparently quite volatile at that point in his career, like where he would kind of lash out at people if they were getting on his nerves. So that would have been very in Donald Sutherland's character. Character's character.
How very unlike a Sutherland.
How very unlike.
The cast of the 70s one, like the 70s one for a lot of different smaller aspects coming together, I think is what elevates it above all the others, because they all have good casts, they all have good elements, but they all just gel a little bit better collectively in the 70s one than in any other version.
I mean, yeah.
You can't really beat the 70s cast. And as we talked about earlier,
yeah,
the soundtrack is so good.
Well, let's break into the trailer for the 78 so you can get a taste of that yourself, and we'll be right back.
They come from a dying world. They drift through the universe, pushed on by the solar winds. They adapt, and they survive. The function of all life is survival.
Sleep. Sleep. Sleep.
From deep space,
sleep.
The seed is planted.
Sleep. Sleep.
Terror grows.
Matthew! Matthew! Matthew!
Wake the others!
Elizabeth, wake up! Get you when you sleep! Sit up!
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
It's got no detail, no character. It's unformed.
All of a sudden, they're growing like parasites. Is it contagious?
People are being duplicated.
How do you know my name? I didn't tell you my name.
You can't find anything in here that looks like a body.
My side's nosebleed.
It looked right at me.
You're looking at it as if it was human, but not human.
Now, the classic fear begins to grow.
We're being cornered.
In a modern masterpiece of science fiction.
They're barricading the street.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Starring Donald Sutherland, Brooke Adams, Leonard Nimoy. Invasion of the Body Snatchers. From deep space, the seed is planted. Terror grows.
That was the trailer for Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1978, directed by Philip Kaufman with a screenplay by W.D. Richter, starring Donald Sutherland as Matthew Bunnell, Brooke Adams as Elizabeth Driscoll, Jeff Goldblum as Jack Belichick, Veronica Cartwright as Nancy Belichick, who makes another appearance in the 2007 The Invasion, and Leonard Nimoy as Dr. David Kibner, him and his stupid glove, and Art Hindle as Dr. Jeffrey Howell.
Yeah, the glove should have gotten a note.
An honorable mention.
The glove played by Glove.
Yeah, I think we can bring it back, guys.
I was wondering if he was a pool player, and it was a nod to the original movie with the pool table, because you will see pool players wearing gloves similar to that. So I'm like, maybe like it's a billiard glove and is like an affectation of the character, but it didn't make sense in context, right? There was no context for it to make it sort of fit the character.
Nah, I just kept thinking like, okay, well, after I saw the mud baths and I'm like, this is just a bohemian affectation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, the end of that movie, the very iconic Donald Sutherland, as we were talking about pointing and screaming, that wasn't the scripted ending. So Donald Sutherland does that at the end of the movie, but Veronica Cartwright didn't know he was going to do it. So her reaction is fairly real.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good actress that can play along with the gag, but at the same time, she probably felt a little freaked out. And if you don't tell her, like, there was probably the director and Donald Sutherland, probably the only ones knew he was going to do it.
And possibly only Donald Sutherland.
Yeah.
And you know what? This is just a note, like, for Veronica Cartwright's career. Because in Alien, when the whole chestburster comes out, they didn't tell anybody about that either. The poor lady.
Right.
She just keeps getting surprised.
Everybody gets a script and she gets a different one. Here's Veronica's script. Don't show her yours.
Yeah. At least she didn't get Chris Pratt's dick or something like that. So,
right.
She's got that going for her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Only Donald Sutherland could really, really pull off that, you know, that head back pointing, mouth open look that he did. Like his eyes go super wide, his mouth is super agape, and it's just so striking. I feel like it's one of those moments where you can't plan for that, and it just works perfectly.
You're right, his eyes especially, because his eyes are so striking to begin with, and then when he does that, it's like, wow, that's just beyond as far as I'm concerned.
The way that scene was originally scripted to play out was he was going to see her, she sees him, and there's just a slight little nod in recognition to see if each other's still okay. That was the original scripted. So, and the way that scene leads up, you're not sure if Donald Sutherland is actually pretending or not. It feels like he is. He's trying to walk among them still. So it does even come as a surprise to the audience, and it's quite something. Like, I remember seeing this one in the 56 fairly in close succession as a kid. I really liked the 56. There was a courtyard image that always stood out in my brain from overlooking from the building as they're loading up the trucks with the pods, and they reproduce that here as well. But I remember being so scared watching the 78, like, keeping in mind I would have been 5. Is it? And it really is, like, still out of all of them, I still find this one probably the scariest among the four.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think I already sort of mentioned that I definitely found it the most discomforting all the way through it. Like, you get this sense of unease all the way through. And then you get that iconic final scene. And it's like, yeah, that's exactly what should have happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably the 90s one has better individual scare scenes. But as a whole, the 70s one is just a great package of dread.
Yeah,
that's a good term, package of dread. I think that that's a really good way of putting it,
because really it's good.
Less about the jump scares and more about that tension that you feel all the way through it. Whereas the 93, they do go for sort of the visual scare and startling you a little bit. And that's never been one of my favorite scares, but it works really well in that 93.
And
coming back to,
you know, it's part of the greatness of all of these films is sort of the idea that it's based on, where they get you when you're asleep. We're humans. We have to sleep. If we don't sleep, stuff goes real, real bad. So the thought, like, and that's also the basis for, like, the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. The fact that you have to sleep is part of the terror. You can't not do the thing that you can't do.
Yeah, I was actually thinking, watching through all of these for the podcast, that a crossover I would love to see is a Nightmare on Elm Street Invasion of the Body Snatchers crossover.
Nice.
Well, yeah. Right? See who gets them first. So they fall asleep and change, and they probably don't dream after that. So Freddy keeps losing his losing ground and losing his victims as they get changed over. It would probably piss him off.
Oh, but I can see Freddy coming in there going, "Wake up! They're taking you over."
Well, and then there's also all the stuff where it's implied the pod people maybe have some sort of hive mind.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, what happens when, if Freddy was to try to get somebody who's part of a hive mind, what does that look like in a dream?
Oh, good God.
I think it's more like maybe in a hive mind like ants are in a way, because you can still walk among them if you're suppressing your emotions. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a natural sense. So if you can just hold back your emotions, they're not going to detect you walking among them. But I don't know. After watching four of these, part of you almost wants to drink the Kool-Aid a little bit. You're like going, well, everybody's a little more peaceful and happy. And I like the way the 2007 ends going, well, we've cured it for better or worse.
Yeah.
Like, is it a better option? I don't know if it is or not being human, but for a passive invasion, but you kind of wonder what the end goal is of that. Does this semi-intelligent virus or spore, for lack of a better term, is its intent to bring peace to planets? Like, what is the end game of it? Or if that's, is that just the life cycle of this spore is to propagate like any other virus?
Yeah. I kind of came up to the conclusion that like it's a parasite, but it's one of those parasites where it can only live if the host lives. So by making us nonviolent, more of the host bodies live. Mm-hmm. So it can propagate and live as like a larger organism for longer.
But it's not a parasite. The only thing it's really taking is the personality. It's creating a whole new body until the 2007, which actually is.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking about.
Yeah.
Well, in the 78, there's a bit of dialogue where they kind of explain that they've been traveling the universe and doing this to planet after planet after planet. So it's suggests that there's intent, right? So it's not random by any means, but what the intent is still kind of ambiguous. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be this thing where it's like what Church was saying, by its very nature, it needs to make people peaceful in order so it can have more host bodies. But at the same time, it could just be that even though they're overtaking people's wills and expanding, which is seen as an aggressive act, they themselves don't seem to be preoccupied with the same things that humans are in terms of like territory control or mm-hmm. ownership.
Well, the thing that kind of confused me a little bit all the way through all four of them actually was the fact that if they're taking over, why are they keeping the memories of these people?
Yeah.
Like, why are they trying to sort of emulate these personalities aside from camouflage? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the only value in that for them.
Well, especially if once you've taken over a planet, what's the use of having those personalities at all?
Exactly.
So it does feel like maybe they're trying to offer a peaceful state. Like, let's face it, if you've been taken over, you're probably not going to war. You're most likely there to propagate your species by, well, we see it, the way they're moving the pods around to infect more and more people. But what happens after that? What happens after a planet's been completely taken over? Do they just live there and then the spores go back out into the universe trying to find another planet to do that with? I don't know. Those are all the questions that are in my head. It's like, well, what mm-hmm. comes after? I don't know.
Yeah, and none of them answered that. I will say the 93 did address, for me, one thing that bugged me about all the other ones. Well, actually, the invasion was viral, so it still worked. But how do they transfer the personality into their new body? Mm-hmm. And at least they had the tendrils and those really graphic tendril scenes, which were really cool, mm-hmm. to sort of show how they transferred that bit that they wanted into the new body.
You know, I almost wonder if it's something like, you remember that Futurama episode where Fry got that virus that it basically just made his body super awesome and it made him super smart and he was like the happiest he'd ever been?
Mm-hmm.
But then eventually he's like, oh, well, people are just loving me for the new me, but not the me that I am, which is dumb. So he rejects it. But a part of me wonders if it's maybe something more along the lines of that, where they're creating a new body, because if they can create a new body from scratch, then it won't have any of the ailments or disease that the other body is infected with. And then it transfers the consciousness and memories of somebody into the new body. And I almost wonder if it's something where their intent is to take other species and then run them through a filter that they think will make the species a more fully realized species. But it's similar to the question of, if you were to upload your entire brain into a computer and then you die and then somebody uploaded everything from your brain into a robot body, like, would that be you, or would that be just a robot imposter who thinks it's you? I mean, you get into those questions with the mm-hmm. series, But a part of me wonders if that's kind of the goal on the pod people side, is that they're trying to purify a species so they can live up to their greatest potential.
Yeah, it does kind of feel that way, because you would have no hate and no malice, and you could live amongst each other as equals all through the thing. But the whole commentary is mindless conformity, something humanity would want.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it also really kind of leans in on the fact of like having no emotions. And I don't know, in some instances, that seems kind of attractive. Like I say, if there's an invasion, my resting bitch face and the fact that I'm dead inside really goes forward to me surviving.
More evidence that she's a pod person.
Yeah.
And always has been.
Always have been.
I feel like one thing I'm really surprised about watching through all of these again is Jay was absolutely right earlier saying how we haven't really explored, you know, what happens afterwards. And I feel like this world is interesting enough that people would want to see further stories told in that type of universe, like a la Planet of the Apes or some of these other science fiction series, where they've really dived into as many different aspects of what this world means. And this is a sandbox for us to play around in. And I'm really surprised that Invasion of the Body Snatchers is not something that's ever happened with.
Because it makes me wonder, like, they sort of introduce it in the invasion where somebody's slightly different. And I mean, this thing is, like you say, it's trying to purify and recreate us. But what happens if there's something just that's just different enough that it sneaks through that little net that it's supposed to be super amazing? And you have somebody who's just a little bit different enough that they're not quite fitting into the collective. Like, that would be kind of an interesting thing to reach into.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because the kid is immune in that movie, and they state there's no room for them in that society, which, how many totalitarian societies have we seen literal genocides on our own planet just for having a different religious view or having a different upbringing or race even? Man, is that unified utopia actually a utopia? Are they actually any better than we are right now if you're trying to eliminate something different? So that raises those kind of questions as well. All right, let's break into the next trailer for Body Snatchers from 1993, because we got lots more to talk about.
There's something in the air, and it feels like fear. There's something in the night, and it seems like terror. There's someone in your bed, and it looks like you.
Mommy?
Life will be simpler now. The only thing missing...
Mommy?
...will be you.
Mommy!
What's the matter, honey? What's the matter?
There's Mommy. She's right there. What happened?
Mommy!
I'm seeing people at the infirmary exhibiting paranoia. People afraid to sleep.
Get in bed.
Afraid of family members.
Let it go!
People afraid of themselves.
We gotta go right now!
Come on, Marty. Let's get out of here.
They're out there. They're everywhere.
Where are you gonna go? Where are you gonna run? Where are you gonna hide? Nowhere. 'Cause there's no one like you left.
Body Snatchers. The invasion continues. They'd kill to be you.
That was the trailer for Body Snatchers from 1993, the only movie to use the actual title of the novel. The only reason they didn't do it in 56 is there was a different movie called Body Snatcher, and that was more about grave robbing. So they wanted to differentiate it and keep it well in the vein of other sci-fis of the era by adding invasion or something like that. And it sounds very 50s sci-fi. And so that's why they did that. This is directed by Abel Ferrara. And I think this is a very underrated movie. Poor movie had a budget of like $13 million and didn't even break $500,000 in its domestic box office. Mm. That's a shame. Lots of people involved in the screenplay for this. The screen story was by Larry Cohen, and screenplay credits go to Raymond Cetheri, Stuart Gordon, Dennis Paoli, and Nicholas St. John. Stuart Gordon was originally set to direct this movie, but obviously that didn't happen and it went to Abel Ferrara. I think it still wound up being in the spirit of what Stuart Gordon would have done.
I would have loved to have seen what Stuart Gordon would have done, but I'm just a really big Stuart Gordon fan.
This is quite an enjoyable movie. Like, I think I didn't see it in theaters, but I think I rented it a few times at the video store because it had a very distinctive cover that I really quite liked.
Yeah, it reminded me sort of that whole, again, back to the whole, it was definitely a snapshot of the 90s with the, because it had sort of that species kind of cover with the sort of half human, half alien face. And it's really quite eye-catching.
Yeah. This movie stars Gabrielle Anwar playing a teenager. She would have been 23 at the time, but she was fairly ageless at that point. Mm-hmm. She plays Marty Malone. Meg Tilly plays Carol Malone. And she has that great speech of where are you going to go? Where are you going to hide?
Love it.
It was wonderful. Terry Kinney was Steve Malone. Riley Murphy was Andy Malone. Bill Wirth was Tim Young. Christine Elise was Jen Platt. R. Lee Ermey was General Platt. He's always got to play a military dude. Kathleen Doyle was Mrs. Platt, and Forrest Whitaker was Major Collins. Now, this was probably the, like, as far as star power goes, I think probably was the lowest on the totem pole of the four, but there's still some big names here. Like, Gabrielle Anwar was kind of like the hot up and comer at the time, and Forrest Whitaker was certainly building that resume by this point.
Yeah. I think he was hot off The Crying Game after this. Like, that was prior to this one.
Oh.
Yeah, and Abel Ferrara was hot off of making Bad Lieutenant, which was pretty successful when it came out. Completely different genre, but I think at the time, a lot of the people attached, they were pretty hot when it came out.
Yeah, because Bill Wirth was,
always be a lost boy to me.
Yes.
Always.
But, and I think that was the problem, is he was always going to be pigeonholed as that sort of pretty rock and roll guy. I really enjoyed him in this. I think that it's a shame that he was an actor who didn't really make it out of that era of pretty boy acting.
Yeah.
Because he was better than his looks.
He was. In this movie, he truly was. And Meg Tilly, I found her interesting in this movie because she has always seemed very otherworldly to me. So to have her be like an alien presence just seemed to fit really well, just like how I see her. She just doesn't seem of this world. I think that worked really well.
Yeah. And I think this was one of her last film roles too, because she left Hollywood soon after this.
Yeah. But she's brilliant in it. Like that speech, again, where are you going to go? What are you going to do? I'm like going, holy crap, she's right. Holy crap.
And that line was sampled a lot in a lot of music.
Oh,
especially
really?
In like in the 90s, there's a lot of like I think John 5 and I think Psychic TV, like a lot of the industrial scene sampled that line a lot.
Where are you gonna go? Where are you gonna run? Where are you gonna hide? Nowhere. Because there's no one like you left.
So did we.
It's a great line.
It is. It's funny, though, when I heard the line and how she delivered that whole speech, I'm like, I really liked it. But at the same time, it felt like having an accent after you've been taking over feels like that would have gone away. So I don't know. It's like part of it bothered me, but I'm not sure that was easily covered up. And I can't really complain about an accent coming through in a performance when Nicole Kidman's was so up and down.
Yeah. One thing that is kind of interesting, so you did, as you mentioned, Stuart Gordon was supposed to be the director, and Dennis Paoli, he's the person who co-wrote Reanimator and From Beyond with Stuart Gordon. So they were partners working together. Whereas Nicholas St. John, he was a writing partner with Abel Ferreira, and he wrote The Driller Killer, which Abel Ferreira directed, as well as a bunch of other movies that he worked on. So I think it's really, really good. But a part of me is wondering which parts are the body horror, over the top excess, you know, From Beyond Reanimator type script that Stuart Gordon and his writing partner would have made. Because obviously this other writer, Nicholas St. John, did a rewrite to do it with the director who was making it because they were partners. So it is a hybrid, but it makes me curious as to what they brought to it, because there's a ton of those Stuart Gordon elements, especially with the special effects scene.
Yeah, I'd say that's Reanimator-esque when you see the changing scenes.
I almost wonder if the Stuart Gordon version would have been more humorous than the version that came out.
Yeah, you can kind of see that with the girl that Gabriel Marty meets when she first gets there. I can't remember her name, but too many names in this one. But well, I can't remember even when it's only one movie, so let's not be kidding ourselves here. But yeah, she was clearly intended sort of to be that sort of comedic foil for Marty and for the movie. But yeah, there wasn't a lot of sort of comedic moments in the film. Like there were a few, but for the most part, it was pretty dark all the way through. Quite literally, that was sort of my one complaint about the film, is it was really dark all the way through it in terms of lighting.
Yeah. Well, there's this one really great moment, and I think it's partly comedic, but it's also very partly dark, is where Marty's talking with her friend, and her friend's like, "Taste this." And she's like, "Well, it's just water." She's like, "Yeah, water. This should be vodka." And I thought that was a really interesting choice, where it's like, oh yeah, your mom's a drunk, but now she's not drunk anymore. So it's obviously not your mom.
You know they're a pod person when they actually want to play bridge.
Right?
Yeah.
I feel like that's just one of those things you feel like you have to do with a neighbor. Fine.
This is the social norm, so we'll do it to fit in.
Yeah.
A card game with partners. That's what we do, because we are all the same. All the same. All the same.
Why couldn't we have key parties like the 70s? Come on.
Right?
Still think Trish is a pod person.
Well, it's like the suburbs, when you get stuck in the suburbs, that scares me. Like, there's several areas around Calgary where you go to one of the suburbs and everything looks the freaking same, and it's so easy to get lost. It's terrifying.
Yeah, I think most big cities have those kind of suburbs at this point. And yeah, there is an argument for how scary the conformity can be of just doing the same thing. I mean, my little community is kind of like that too, where everything looks the same. It's the reason why I keep my blinds shut. It's unnerving.
Yeah. Like, I'm afraid if I stop at one barbecue, I'm never going to return. Like, that's just what happens.
One of us. Yeah.
Right?
Kind of the feeling in some communities, yes.
Now, I don't think anybody would argue to say this one was maybe one of the bigger departures by the third movie, trying something different, new characters, new situations. But by still pulling in a lot of the aspects from the 70s, it still has some of those key iconic moments. Again, the loading of the trucks with the pods.
Yeah.
Some of those key visuals, even some of those key lines, we have one of those military officers right at the beginning doing that same warning that you would have got from Kevin McCarthy in the original film. So structurally, it's very similar while putting it in a different setting of the military base. And it does make sense that an outbreak would start there, because then your resistance goes away. So I like the cleverness of that. This one doesn't rate as high as the other two. In fact, I'm going to go through this here. IMDb gives the original a 7.7 out of 10, while the Rotten Tomatoes is really impressive for the 56 at 98% and 85%.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so everybody really loves that. The 78 is just slightly below that. IMDb gives it a 7.4 out of 10, where the Rotten Tomatoes is a 93% critic score and an 82% audience score. The underappreciated Body Snatchers from 1993 drops to a 6.0 out of 10 on IMDb. And Rotten Tomatoes is 70% critic score. So critics still really like this movie. And in the case of Roger Ebert, he actually thought it was the best of the lot up to that point. And audience score, 39%. So audiences weren't digging it, at least the ones that write articles on Rotten Tomatoes.
But that's surprising. Really shocking, actually.
Yeah, but I'll give you the final ones on the 2007 in a little bit.
There was one aspect of this that was slightly a departure, but I kind of really dug, where the pod people were actually testing others with asking them questions to see how they would react. Like the one friend is like, Andy's looking for you. And she's like, just to try and see if she would ask, because if she's a pod person, she's not going to ask. And that's how they get caught. But in the other one where the guy tells Billy Worth, he's like, yeah, I screwed your girlfriend, to see if he'll react. And then when he manages to keep everything under control, they're like, okay, so fine, you can take the helicopter. I thought that was a really clever note, because it would be really smart of the entity to try and test people, because they know that humans have emotions. So to test them would be the best way to just ferret out the
and that's
ones who aren't changed.
Yeah, and that's an aspect that they bring back in the 2007 in sometimes very disturbing ways. You have that couple that just takes a header off the building, calmly walks off, and then, of course, somebody freaks out on the street. Oh, well, I got to grab her, drug her, and send her to sleep. So there were aspects of that. And, of course, some not nearly as extreme, but especially with that little Asian boy neighbor, the way he continuously ferrets out Nicole Kidman's character.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of reactions, I want to go back to the 78 for just one moment. The dog with the human face.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness.
How could we
forgot about that.
And I was really impressed with that being a 78 film. I'm like, man, this one really effects-wise pushes the boundaries of what you could even do then. Like, I was thinking, like, this is kind of on the level of John Carpenter's The Thing a decade earlier. Like, wow, well, maybe about 5-6 years earlier. But still, like, how good that looked. I mean, they kept it pretty brief so you don't stay on it too long and then see the fakeness of it. But it's kind of shocking when you see it initially. I'm like, oh, there's a pod that went wrong. It was probably somebody who fell asleep with his dog. You can actually figure out in your head how that happened.
I screamed when I saw it.
Yeah, your first reaction is, what the fuck?
Yep.
Yeah, like it's like something that has stepped out of a nightmare. Like, it's so unexpected and so out of left field.
And I love that they only do it once. It's like, this is what can happen. We're not going to like overdo it and desensitize you to it. Make that moment really shocking and leave it as shocking and nothing else. And I liked that too.
And no other film did it.
Nope.
Every single time I watch the 70s one, that's something I always forget about because it's so brief and it gets me every time.
It's unnerving. Like, I can close my eyes right now and see it again. And eventually that memory will fade and then I'll get surprised again.
Yeah, good call. That was a great moment in the 70s one.
Yeah, if you want to test people, that's a surefire way.
Yeah, I guess that kind of worked too, because they were walking among them and then you see the dog. Oh, the gig's up now. Maybe that's the point of why they kept it around. Because this is going to shock anybody. If they aren't one of us, that'll get it. That'll make it happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that kind of goes back to our other question. What happens if pods go wrong? Like, they kept the dog face guy. I wonder if a pod did go wrong, would they keep somebody?
Yeah. I mean, we saw what happens if somebody wakes up midstream and then the half pod person kind of melts away, sometimes crawls away and dies, but it can't fully form if you haven't completed your REM sleep and that body hasn't fully formed yet. And it needs time to gestate. And in some cases, like this movie, once it's done, because initially, I'm like, what do they wind up doing with the body afterwards once you have the duplicate? And the 78, you don't see exactly what happens, but there's a suggestion that there is waste because you're constantly seeing the garbage truck pulling away with fuzzy stuff all over the place. I was unsure why everything was so furry.
Right? It was like every time I saw a garbage truck, I'm like, oh, they emptied the lint trap.
Yeah, it was like the world's biggest lint trap. So yeah. I was a little puzzled by it, but I guess it, you know, maybe a leftover vegetable matter after something hatched. But I kept wondering what happened to the human being, which is something they address by the 93, which
to be fair,
desiccates
I'm sure
and falls away.
to be fair, I'm sure a lint trap contains a lot of human cells. So maybe it is.
Yeah. You know, if I was to hazard a guess for the 70s one, I would say that they would use the bodies for fertilizer for the pod plants.
Yes.
Oh, that's a good... I would think Alien Society wouldn't want to waste anything. The garbage trucks return in the 93, but at least we see what happens so you know what's kind of in those trash bags is what's, what little remains are left after the original host body desiccates, kind of deflates.
Yeah, it was cool to watch, though.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, top-notch special effects in that third one. It's like a lot of people talk about great special effects in horror movies, especially horror sci-fi. You have John Carpenter's The Thing, which obviously has great effects. And
yeah,
you know, we all can think of a list of movies that have amazing science fiction horror effects. And I never hear people talk about this one, but I think it is one of my favorites. It just purely effects wise, where they get across a lot of really creepy imagery, and the way that they do the transformations and the whole process is so well done. And it's just a high level of practical craft that you don't really see a lot these days.
Yeah.
Yeah. And practical really kind of adds something to it. It feels like a substantive thing. And that's what makes it more terrifying.
Yeah. When you think about these, like the original one, I would firmly classify as a science fiction movie. By 78, I would call it a sci-fi horror. By 93, I would call it a horror science fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a pretty accurate assessment of the progression.
All right, I'm going to run the trailer for the 2007 The Invasion. We'll be right back to figure out what that one is.
A piece came out of the sky.
Pieces all over the pasture and in the yard.
Why is it important for people not to touch it?
It's contaminated. Could be contaminated.
Something's happening. I don't know what it is, but I can feel it. Have you noticed anything?
I have.
I want to help you, but you have to talk to me.
My husband is not my husband.
What's going on here?
Listen to her.
Imagine a world where human beings cease to be human.
Change occurs when the body undergoes REM sleep. We'll watch each other. Make sure we don't fall asleep.
You can fool them.
What?
Don't show emotion. Then they can't tell who's who.
My child!
We're gonna do whatever it takes to get through this.
Mom? Mom!
Feel exactly the same.
That was the trailer for The Invasion from 2007 with directors Oliver Hirschbegel and uncredited James McTeague, who did some kind of after shoots and was uncredited. The screenplay was by David Kajanik, and rewrites were actually done by the Wachowskis.
Oh, wow.
Who did the rewrite stuff for James McTeague. This kind of thing, when you hear about that, you're like, oh, studio interference. I wonder what they were originally trying to do.
Yeah. And
one of those stories that we'll probably never actually hear. This one was budgeted at $80 million, had an opening weekend in the U.S. of just under $6 million, went on to gross $15 million in the U.S. and only $40 million worldwide. Did not do well. That was two Body Snatcher remakes in a row that were not profitable, but had a hell of a cast. Nicole Kidman as Carol Bunnell, Daniel Craig as Ben Driscoll, Jeremy Northam as Tucker Kaufman, Jackson Bond as Oliver, Jeffrey Wright as Dr. Stephen Galliano, Veronica Cartwright returns here as Wendy Lenk, Joseph Summer was Dr. Henry Belichick, and Cecilia Weston was Lumilla Belichick. Give you the quick stats here. 5.9 out of 10 for IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes. This is where I'm going to let you guys take a guess. What do you think the critic score was for The Invasion?
Critic score.
12%.
Okay, 12 for Jeff.
I was going to be a little more generous and say 48%.
48 for Sam.
I think they might have enjoyed it, maybe. Let's go 52.
52. The closest without going over is Jeff. 19% critic score. Fucking hated it. They fucking hated it.
I'm to be honest, I was not a big fan of the Invasion.
No, it feels fairly dry and lifeless to me as well. Audience score were a little kinder. In fact, they were even a little more kinder to this one than Body Snatchers from 93. Only by a percent, though. 40% audience score. So not well loved, and it does feel a bit dry and lifeless to me as well, which I guess is kind of the point.
Leah had a really good point while we were watching it, actually, where basically with every single other iteration, they kind of get to where they're going relatively quickly. Like, they set up some good intrigue, and they set up that there's other people around who are already taken over, and then you're into it. But it takes a really long time to get where it's going in the 2007 one.
It does.
That's part of it, yeah. And then when you have an actress of Nicole Kidman's caliber, and Daniel Craig for that matter, who are delivering phone-in performances, basically, I mean, I did not connect to Kidman's character at all, and there was no chemistry in her relationship with Craig at all. So it's really hard to enjoy a movie when you can't even connect with your leads.
Yeah, and Craig had to leave set often because during the filming of this, he was announced as the new James Bond. So he actually had to leave set to do the press junket, the press announcement that he was the new James Bond.
And it came out the same year as The Golden Compass, which also had Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig in it. So I really wonder what the production timeline looks like for both movies. And like, it seems strange that they're both in this higher budget movie that's an adaptation of these big books, and then they're also in this other movie together, which feels like it's a much smaller production. But like, was that a one for me, one for you contract type thing? Or like, what was going on there?
No idea.
Neither movie did well, though.
No.
No. Yeah.
That's true. I did like how the movie opened, though, with the news articles and it that explains how this spore made it to the planet. This is the only one that actually doesn't have pods, by the way. And they're using basically, and it might have been a little distasteful in 2007, but they were using the Columbia reentry disaster as the inspiration for this opening, as the spore had attached it to whatever was left of this shuttle reentry accident and spread itself across the United States. And as people were touching it, they were getting infected, and then they'd go to sleep and the infection would take hold while they were asleep. This virus that can exist in space, this intelligent virus.
This is what's the funny part. We're talking about how long it takes stuff to get started. In this movie, the infection's like in the first 5 minutes, and then it takes a nice long breather to get things started, which I think it loses momentum.
Well, I think they were supposed to show that life was still fairly normal at the time. And as it progresses, like, its infection rate is fairly high and fairly quick.
Mm-hmm.
But when it feels like it's taken forever in a movie that's just barely over an hour and a half,
something's dragging. Yeah. I do have to admit that I really enjoyed the scenes where she's counseling that woman, and she's talking about how she's trying to get out of this bad relationship, but now all of a sudden he's changed and he's now somehow scarier.
Yeah,
that I really liked. That's probably my favorite part of the film, is that dynamic, how something that tragic and horrible and terrifying as being in an abusive relationship can become even more terrifying.
Yeah, as the what is normal goes away, and the person that you've had this even abusive relationship has changed into something even more distrusting. And it was a nice twist on, there was always somebody putting out that warning that first somebody running down the street going, my husband's not my husband, or whoever. It was a nice twist on that in a less panicky kind of way, because that would kind of sit in the back of your brain, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if you'd be running down the street like that, but I think the movie's fairly successful showing that build as more and more society does that, and she's seeing this more and more around her in her everyday life.
Yeah. Just people standing and staring.
Exactly. And I think that whole thing is also part of where the movie falls apart, because you find Kidman's character getting really invested in this one woman. And a lot of movies sort of sidetracks into her trying to find her instead of focusing on the bigger picture. And it's not often that I'll complain about a movie foregoing or spending too much time on minutia. But in this case, I think they did. I think they spent way too much time on these smaller side stories instead of giving you more of that big picture.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of wonder, thinking about it in terms of being reshot, I was just looking it up, and it seems like a lot of the action scenes were all written by the Wachowskis, which checks out, where you have that scene where they're all on top of the car and she's driving away and there's like 15 people hanging off of it. That feels like a Wachowski thing. But then on the flip side, Malin Ackerman is in this movie, but she's not credited. I imagine that she might have been in the movie more, and I wonder if there was a larger cast of characters in the initial version of the movie versus this one, which was really heavily about Nicole Kidman primarily, and a little bit Daniel Craig.
Yeah, because she's in a very brief kind of moment, and she's sort of upset that she stayed awake because somebody was home late. It's like, you should have called.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like a very throwaway entire scene, if I'm honest. I mean, I kind of quickly forgot about it halfway through the movie.
I wonder if the stuff with the other, with the older woman, like, did kind of come back and play into the story much more, but amongst the shuffle of the reshoots, the intention just kind of got lost along the way.
Well, she's one of those people where they figure out she's immune. I mean, they come back to it, but I don't know how to say this. It's not really followed through well, I think, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I think that you said it very well. And Malin Ackerman's character, I mean, she was only there to establish sort of, I think, subtly, almost to the point of failing, is that Kidman's husband left her for a younger woman.
Mm.
Right. I think that's what the whole point of that was. And that was her only purpose, was to show how reprehensible her ex-husband is. Doesn't see his kid, left her for a younger woman, moved out of town, like all those things that sort of those stereotypical rotten man tropes, they kind of cram them all into that first few scenes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. That would make sense. Yeah. Cause it like flips by so fast. I didn't really grasp any of that, really.
Yeah. No, actually, surprisingly enough, I did right after the get. I'm like, ooh, this guy's a dick.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got that fairly quickly, but did it serve the purpose? Not really. His characterization didn't matter that much, except to show how different he was when he wanted to see his son and spend time with his son all of a sudden. That change in personality, I guess, but it was ham-fisted.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the politics of the movie were pretty ham-fisted as well, especially for the time. I think that actually, the further we're away from that period of time, I think the more you can really see all of these tropes that we didn't realize were happening in the mid-2000s, but especially with a lot of the politics and the way that the action was handled. And at the very beginning, where she's in the pharmacy and she's trying to get all of the medication and stuff, and then it cuts back to way earlier in the story, all that stuff is just very tropey of movies that came out in that time period.
It's like, oh, here's the start of my story. Let me catch you up.
Yeah, another big blockbuster with paint by numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all Christopher Nolan's fault.
And I would say that some of the sleep aspect, it was handled similarly to the you can't sleep aspect that was in the Nightmare on Elm Street remake, where it's more of an action-y type setting where you have characters falling asleep in the middle of a crazy situation, and then they have to take speed or something, and then they're fine for another 5 minutes. But I don't really find that believable, like especially when she's in the car. And all of a sudden there's like 20 people on top of her car and her kids screaming, but then she just falls asleep.
Oh, I thought she was knocked really unconscious. I thought they crashed and she got knocked unconscious.
Hmm.
That's what Maybe. I thought too.
Oh, and hey, the kid shoving adrenaline or whatever drugs into her chest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I kept thinking, I mean, I don't know if anybody's had to like take some sort of like any sort of medications, but I'm sure there's some where it's like it disrupts your sleep, but it can disrupt the REM portion of your sleep. Mm-hmm. Like just so you get that. So I wondered why they never even touched on that. Cause you can have like sleeping medications that make you go to sleep. You don't really dream,
but you don't
yeah. you go to sleep.
No, absolutely. Well, I thought that exact same thought.
Yeah. Have you ever been knocked unconscious?
Once.
Okay. You don't REM sleep when you're unconscious.
Yeah.
No.
So,
but you do have fun waking up and figuring out where you are.
Yes. Because like, it's just a blank period.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's happened to me more than once.
And, oh, where did yours happen?
Let's see. Soccer ball when I was 8. Knocked myself out falling off of something. Knocked myself out hitting on something. Yeah, I hit my head a lot.
Oh, wow. Me, it's just once on a ski hill.
Oh, yeah, once on a ski hill, too. I forgot about that one.
It's a wonder
bad.
That you're not like and I'm not playing hockey. Slasher or yeah. something. Yeah.
I got one for soccer. That was it.
Wow, soccer's dangerous.
I passed out once because I didn't eat all day. It's very similar as well.
Yeah. I used to think I was an athlete. I've since realized that I'm not. So I don't knock myself out anymore, but
yeah.
That's good.
It made me wonder about comas too, if you just like induced a quick coma. And then got people out of it.
Because, you know, I didn't love the REM sleep aspect. Like, they're trying to make it overly scientific, but without necessarily justifying any of it. Like, the whole REM sleep thing I didn't super buy. And yeah. also, because of COVID specifically, the whole, like, immunity thing, you realize that, like, in I Am Legend, they have this thing where, oh, you can be immune to the zombie virus. And in this movie, they're like, oh, people have natural immunity. But as we've found out, I don't know if anybody would be immune to an alien virus that comes completely outside of our virus pool. Like COVID supposedly came from a different direction, and there's almost no examples at all of people being immune because the virus adapts to overcome any suggested immunity that people might naturally have, just because it's something that our physiology's never dealt with in the way that it has.
Well, my big beef with that particular one is, okay, the kid's immune, but wouldn't he be developed that immunity from either parent, neither one of which was immune?
Yeah.
They explained that. It's a treatment for that childhood disease. I can't remember if it was measles or
chickenpox.
Yeah, it was an advanced strain of chickenpox.
Yeah, so it was the treatment to make him immune, not a genetic disposition or even the chickenpox itself. It was what they used to treat him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, it was a very particular brand of treatment. So it wouldn't be passed down. But it made me think too of like how like there's other viruses they change and grow. Like there's super gonorrhea that they can't do anything about because it changed and it knows no fear. Like, so viruses are like, he could be immune now, but if the virus adapts, he could not be immune tomorrow.
I mean, in judging, like, if the virus is as strong as it is, based off of what Jeffrey Wright's character was saying, where it could survive, you know, unfathomable temperatures, and that's how it was able to get onto the shuttle of this ship that crashed, it would be able to adapt to stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, there's bacteria that lives in lava. Like, there's some wild crap out in the world. It's insane. Life finds a way, as Jeff Goldblum said in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think ultimately we're saying that this one is by far the most flawed of all of them in more ways than one. I mean, I don't think it was clear that even to a person that it was a remake of any of the Body Snatchers movies. Because, I mean, it wasn't until we started doing the podcast, actually, and I started searching ourselves. I'm like, what the hell is this? I'm like, oh, it's a remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers that I never heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, when it came out, I think, because I rented it when it came out on DVD, but basically, from what I remember, the studio thought that the script was different enough that it could be a thing all on its own. So it wasn't marketed or really mentioned that it had anything to do with Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Then you pop the DVD in and you watch it and you're like, oh, this is just Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but with a virus.
Yes. So all they changed was they made it a virus instead of pods.
Yeah. Because even the psychiatrist main character and stuff and everything, like the story through line is pretty similar.
Yeah, no, it's fairly similar. I remember being so disappointed when I saw this in the theater. I saw it in the theater. Probably had screeners. But I remember seeing it being so disappointed that the pods weren't there. It was such a thing with the rest of them. It's like, well, pod person, that's where that comes from. How can you do Invasion of the Body Snatchers without pods?
Apparently you can't.
And it takes away from one of my favorite visuals was everybody coalescing in the town square and loading up to bring these elsewhere instead of just, you know, vomiting in people's drinks. That was gross.
Yeah.
Oh, that was gross. That really made me uncomfortable. Did not like that. And yeah, and then the other bit too, where it's like you get these things that are unformed. The concept of like a fully grown human body, but basically with the attributes of a fetus, and that's not fully formed. Mm-hmm. That is creepy as hell.
Yeah.
And like you say, other movies without the pods don't work as well. Like The Faculty. That's not pods.
Yeah.
But to be fair, the one thing that this movie actually does do is actually snatch bodies. None of the rest do. They clone bodies. This is the only one where they actually take the body and hijack it.
But it's ironically the only one that doesn't have body snatcher in the title.
Exactly. Irony of the whole
thing. Sam, our remake last week of Robot Monster was more body snatchers.
It was definitely more body snatchers. And so, actually, you know what? It's funny. We were talking about the dog human hybrid. Yeah. Kind of talked about in last week's episode as well.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, wow. True. Yeah, we kind of touched on that a little bit as well. Can you think of any more body snatcher type of movies that certainly would have been inspired by that? There was even actually a short-lived TV series called Invasion that spun out of this as well. Yeah. So not directly, but they were trying to do this in another small town kind of way over a much longer period of time.
I'm going to introduce a sub-genre of this whole body snatcher idea, which is the Stepford Wives and those types of movies and disturbing behavior, where it's people that you know, but they're being modified and replaced with quote unquote better versions of themselves.
Interesting. I wouldn't have connected another those way. Movies, but that's a really similar, it's a really similar theme.
Yeah. It's not an alien hybrid, but it's a human made version of, you know, imposters.
Well, they all cover that same fear, which is the loss of personality, right? Because that's really what this is about, is the loss of identity and the loss of personality. Mm-hmm. Who are you when you're not you anymore?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the thing would also kind of fit into that genre as well.
Yeah. What else we got? Mentioned The Faculty, The Puppet Masters. Oh, another Donald Sutherland movie, too.
Yeah. Also mentioned in The Faculty.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Day of the Triffids.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There was a book we had in the library that scared the ever-living crap out of me. And it had pictures in it, which made me think that they made a movie of it, but I don't think they did. But it was like these spores that came from space. And what they did was they turned humans into plants. And that scared the absolute... Like, it took them over, but it like made them into a plant.
And that was creepy as hell. Because I read that when I was in grade 4, and I've been trying to remember the name of it ever since.
I can't. I can see it in my head, but I don't remember the name of it. So, yeah, you know the book I'm talking about.
I do know
the book. And it had pictures.
Yes, and I remember it scaring the shit out of me when I was 8 years old.
Yes.
If only we didn't have an army of invaders listening to us right now, one of which holds the answer to that question. Please leave that answer on one of our social media platforms, at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and invasiontheremake@gmail.com, so Sam can get some sleep. Oh, wait. Don't get any sleep, Sam. Don't.
Story of my life. Don't sleep.
I just want to introduce one final thought about this, too, where we talk about getting replaced. When you think about your body and all the cells that are dying and getting replaced all the time, like, theoretically, they say every 8 years, you are a new you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that goes the difference between your physical being and your conscious being, right?
But, I mean, your brain cells kind of go, but, yeah, stuff changes. Your body changes. It's
that
very
means
weird.
Over the last 8 years, if I never vacuumed, there would be another me in my
You
rug.
Could clone you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if you could just put that into a mold and then, you know, pop it in the oven, bake it up. New Jay.
Jay wouldn't fit in an oven.
I'm not a shrinky dink.
he'd have to cook them in like sections in the oven and then just assemble the body parts later.
Some yep. fucking weight crack.
You know, one thing I did actually want to mention, and this kind of ties it back to the very first movie we covered, The Day the Earth Stood Still, The Body Snatcher, the one that doesn't have anything to do with pod people, that stars Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi, that's directed by Robert Wise, who did The Day the Earth Stood Still, and is actually my favorite Robert Wise movie. So also worth checking out if you like the title, The Body Snatcher, but want to see it applied to something that's not aliens.
And tied back to a previous episode.
Yes.
Yeah.
But not the first one we did, because that was Earth versus the Flying Saucers.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. You're right.
But that's, Jeff, also tied back to the very first episode, because he mentioned I Am Legend.
That's right. That yeah. was definitely our very first episode.
Yes, and it tied back to last time that four movies were covered in one episode, too, I think.
Yes.
Yes, never to be attempted again until this very episode, but I think we did a little bit better this go around.
Well, we're a little more experienced now.
More succinct, yeah.
Yes, yes, that's what happens with 6 years of experience.
We bit off more than we could do that first time, but we know better now.
Overall, how do you guys feel about Alien Invasion April, except for Trish, because we know she doesn't feel anything at all.
Yeah.
Because I think we're all on board that she's podded, right? She's a pod person. Maybe we're all pod people.
Yeah, I think
people.
I've been podded since I was young. But to be fair, half my family is from Vulcan, so that could mean that's why I don't have any emotion.
Oh, and Leonard Nimoy was in one of these, so it all, you know, all rolls back around.
See people make jokes that his glove was to prevent him from doing a Vulcan salute on set.
It's funny because he did an episode of Star Trek where he was sprayed by a plant and became very emotional. And in this one, it was the opposite.
Ooh.
So there you
very
go.
Very nice.
I really like alien invasion movies. I've always been a fan of aliens as a concept, even outside of movies, just generally in fiction and the conspiracies involved around, you know, aliens visiting Earth. Like, I've always been a big fan of X-Files. So usually anything alien invasion themed, I've been a pretty big mark for. So yeah, it was a fun month. And with Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I do think that even though relatively recently they did the invasion in 2007, I almost feel like it's due for some like similar revival that Planet of the Apes had, where it's less of a remake and more a new series exploring the, you know, the world that's set up in the original movie.
Well, there is another one actually in development.
Oh, wow.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, and if you want to fall down a real deep internet hole, I believe it's called Capgras Syndrome, which is the idea that all of your family has been replaced by imposters. It can get weird and dark, but it's quite interesting.
Which could be an interesting angle on a remake again, another remake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I had fun this month, too. I really enjoyed all these 50s sci-fi movies. I don't think it was our intent to continuously be in the 50s, but damn, I sure was entertained by it. There's a lot of fun movies in the 50s, and hopefully
there's so much fun.
Yeah, and hopefully we've kind of reintroduced these to our audience because, man, they're really, really worth rewatching. I loved everything we watched, even Robot Monster, which was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was so much fun to watch, though. It was terrible. But, I mean, I was kind of cringing a little bit because I'm a huge science fiction fan, but this genre or this segment of science fiction was never one of my sort of go-to ones. So most of these were new for me. Actually, all of them except for the original Day of the Earth still were new to me. So it was fun for me in that sense because these are movies that I probably wouldn't have watched of my own accord.
There's a joy and an earnestness to some of these that you don't get very often anymore, where it's like they're approaching with such seriousness, but also a sense of fun.
I feel like a lot of 50 sci-fi kind of in a unique way that we don't get as much anymore in science fiction. It still happens, just not as much, is there's a lot of vision in 1950s science fiction where it's a very deliberate story that's being told. Like there's lots of, you know, schlaff like Robot Monster, but I feel like the more popular science fiction becomes, the more expensive those movies become, the more studios want to make sure they get a return on their investment, and you kind of maybe lose some of those aspects of some really good 50s sci-fi where the writer or the director have a very, very solid vision of what they want out of it. Yeah, I love 50s science fiction for that reason. And it's been a joy to be revisiting all of these movies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, if there's another 50s science fiction movie, please let us know. I've already told you our social media handles, but again, it is at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and invasiontheremake@gmail.com, where you can send us your suggestions, your corrections, and your comments, and of course, fan challenges. And now that we are through Alien Invasion April, we will finally start getting back to some fan challenges and remaking some of the stuff you want to see us and our brains rework into another film. It's amazing when I get a request for a fan challenge and they say it's one of their favorite films and inevitably going, well, if it's your favorite film, do you really want me to come in and fuck with it? All right.
Or worse, hack on it.
Yes, because chances are we are going to go, that's your favorite film? Oh, no. Oh, no.
Oh, honey.
Have we got some movies to show you? But not always. Not always. Sometimes there's some hidden gems in there. But we're always happy to see what you come up with. And let us know, of course, on our social media what you might want to see next. Nothing after the year 2000. That's still kind of too new in my mind. Tell us where to find it, make a case for it, why you think it might be worthy of our take. We kind of like to do some of the weirder things. And if it's already a Citizen Kane of its world and its genre, yeah, we're not going to touch it with a 10-foot pole. So, if it's already a good movie that you might have a slight beef with, that's going to be on you because we're not going to remake it. But another way you can help out the show is by visiting our website and telling everybody else who isn't listening to the show at the moment, tell them where to find it, give them the web link. And Sam, where can they find that?
That would be invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast.
And over there, you'll find lots of links to podcatchers that you can find us on. We're on all sorts of podcast platforms at this point. We're on most of the majors. So really easy to find now. And of course, there is a store button right on top of the front page. And that'll take you to our T Public store where you can find all sorts of cool swag, posters, t-shirts, mugs, PPE masks, stickers, magnets, and a whole lot more, hoodies, lots of cool stuff there. We're adding stuff all the time, and we've been doing that quite a bit during Alien Invasion April. We're a little behind, but we're going to get some more stuff up there very soon. So you can relive Alien Invasion April with some cool swag and going, hey, that was a cool movie. I wouldn't mind wearing it on my chest or on my face. That sounded weird. You do you.
Be you. Be wild. Be free.
That's right.
We're going through some shit right now. Just be yourself.
But do it with an Earth versus the Flying Saucers t-shirt.
Yes.
or a Gort or whatever we come up for this one. I don't know. We'll find something. All right, well, that was it for Alien Invasion April and all the Invasion of the Body Snatcher movies this week. We're back to doing something a little more traditional next month, and we'll give sci-fi a little bit of a rest, but don't worry, we got lots of cool content coming up. Until then, I'm pretty sure I'm still human. I've been your host, Jason.
I am always Sam.
I pod continue to be Trish.
Pod Trish?
I always return, but maybe not always as the same person, but I still call myself Jeff Omega.
And we are out of here.